Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Remake the World, Essays, Reflections, Rebellions, by Astra Taylor, narrated by Christina Delane. 1. Breathing Together. It's as natural as breathing is a cliche because, when all is going well, nothing else is more effortless than inhaling and exhaling, something we do approximately 20,000 times a day. Typically, most of us don't think much about it. We breathe as we sleep, breathe as we eat, breathe as we move, and breathe as we talk. But that changed in 2020. We worried about our lungs and gasped for air. A novel illness sickened millions and tanked the global economy. Thousands ingested tear gas protesting police violence, and cities were smothered by plumes of dark, noxious smoke from nearby forest fires. During the first tense few weeks of the COVID-19 shutdown, we thought we could stop the spread of the disease by washing our hands. Our hands were something we could control. We could keep them in our pockets, wear latex gloves, have sanitizer at the ready, and scrub off the pathogen with soap and hot water. We didn't have all the facts. The coronavirus, as U.S. authorities knew by early February, is airborne, transmitted through invisible particles and droplets emitted and ingested during the most automatic of physical acts. The pandemic has revealed that our bodies function more like sponges than fortresses. My sister, the disability rights activist and scholar Sonora Taylor, observed. In a variety of visualizations, we see our bodies extending beyond their usual bounds. Graphics of our coughs, sneezes, and even breath show how far beyond our own skin our bodies reach. The 6-foot rule of social distancing, a daily acknowledgement that our bodies not only leak and ooze, but that they absorb the conditions of others. Epidemiology and physics collude to prove that even at a seemingly safe distance, we touch by virtue of breathing the same air. In the worst cases, COVID-19 causes acute respiratory distress. Experts describe succumbing to the disease as akin to drowning. Early in the outbreak, I read a piece by a doctor attempting to educate readers about how our lungs operate and what contracting the illness might entail. "A healthy lung is so soft," she wrote, "it has almost no substance. Touching it feels like reaching into a bowl of whipped cream." COVID changes that, filling the twin organs with a yellow goo that blocks the free flow of oxygen. The lung texture changes, beginning to feel more like a marshmallow than whipped cream. To be soft and permeable like a sponge is to be healthy. To be rigid and closed off, fortress-like, spells doom. This is true, it turns out, not just for our lungs, but also for our very selves. When we breathe, we pull air into our windpipe, or trachea. That pipe then splits into our lungs 2 main airways, called bronchi, which then branch off into smaller and smaller passageways, leading to tiny twig-like tubes called bronchioles that culminate in clusters of microscopic sacs called alveoli. In medical diagrams, these passageways resemble the branches of an upside-down tree, as though every human being contains a piece of an inverted forest inside their chest. It's a fitting image, because if it weren't for trees, we wouldn't be able to breathe. By photosynthesizing, plants generate carbohydrates and oxygen in equal measure, nourishing our bellies and filling our lungs. Without them, we'd starve, but not before we choked on lethal levels of carbon dioxide. In this sense, the thousands of fires that raged across North America in 2020, burning more than 8 million acres, charred the lungs of the earth. In those months, some communities gagged on smoke, others on pepper spray. On May 25th, 46-year-old George Floyd was asphyxiated by Derek Chauvin, a Minneapolis police officer who kneeled on Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds with an expression of untouchable, detached superiority. Floyd's alleged transgression was using a counterfeit $20 bill. The assault was caught on video, and perhaps because the pandemic had slowed things down, people paid attention. Floyd's murder galvanized the biggest protest movement in U.S. history, attracting up to 26 million participants by midsummer. Police and federal agents responded with unrelenting force, blinding over a dozen eyes with rubber bullets and burning thousands of people's lungs with chemical weapons, including smoke grenades. In Portland, Oregon, residents used leaf blowers for self-defense, redirecting fumes away from innocent crowds and back toward the cops. Floyd's last words echoed Eric Garner, who uttered a phrase that would become a common chant at Black Lives Matter protests as he was killed by police in New York City in 2014. "I can't breathe." In streets full of tear gas, demonstrators couldn't breathe either. The right wing, predictably, responded to these developments with aggressive denial. Millions of people already devoted to conspiracy theories merely had to add a few new twists to pre-existing narratives to bring them up to date. The coronavirus, like global warming, was a hoax, an elaborate ruse by an elite and evil cabal to control the populace, not a pandemic but a plandemic. Likewise, the fires in California and Washington were not connected to shifting weather patterns caused by greenhouse gas emissions, but the result of arson, violent acts committed by mythic anarchists and anti-fascists who were never found, but who were certainly in cahoots with Black Lives Matter. From his White House perch, Donald Trump amplified falsehoods, uplifted racists, and sowed confusion and doubt. Research showed that he was the single largest source of disinformation about COVID-19. While condemning millions to disease and destitution, Trump told his followers they were victims not of a vastly unequal society, helmed by a sociopathic plutocrat no less, but of public health protocols and marginalized groups seeking equal rights. He comforted those afflicted with delusions that a reassertion of white supremacy and a revolt against a spectral deep state could cure the crisis. A network of right-wing individuals and foundations funded and fomented discontent, emboldening armed vigilantes who gathered at state capitals demanding a return to business as usual. In Michigan, the 14 men arrested for plotting to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer foreshadowed the throng that would enter the nation's capital on January 6, 2021, as Congress was certifying Joe Biden's electoral victory. Carrying weapons and plastic handcuffs, seemingly ready to take hostages, conservative fanatics overran security, denouncing traitors, wearing Confederate flags, wearing neo-Nazi T-shirts, shouting racial slurs, and beating one Trump-supporting cop to death after he dared block their path. Instead of being snapped back to their senses by a fatal illness, people retreated further into fantasy and fallacy, in which face masks were part of a far-reaching conspiracy to suffocate patriots and stifle freedom. According to my dictionary, a conspiracy is a plotting of evil, unlawful design, a combination of persons for an evil purpose. This is the definition that describes the most popular conspiracy theories of our day, which claim to ferret out a demonic sect pulling society's strings, whether they are nefarious globalists, Jewish bankers, a satanic pedophile ring, a shadow government, or some dastardly combination thereof. While such misapprehensions are as old as the nation itself, some historians point out that the United States was born of a conspiracy theory, as evidenced by the Declaration of Independence's paranoid litany of Britain's abuses and usurpations, including unleashing merciless Indian savages and absolute despotism. The Trump era was uniquely steeped in them. Trump's rise to power began with the racist lie of birtherism, insisting that Barack Obama was not a true U.S. citizen. and ended in the authoritarian insistence that the election was rigged and stolen by socialist Democrats with the help of some disloyal Republican officials, among them Attorney General William Barr and Vice President Mike Pence. While people on the political left are not immune to it, this kind of conspiracism is more endemic among and useful to the right wing. If we go farther back, however, we'll find the word conspiracy has a different, more profound meaning that might help us comprehend our present predicament. It comes from the Latin conspirationem, agreement, union, unanimity, and conspirare, to be in agreement, to ally, or literally, to breathe together. This is what the more powerful segment of society, the ruling class, have never wanted the rest of us to do, to come together as allies and, God forbid, form unions. Throughout U.S. history, the most influential and destructive conspiracies have emanated not from the fringes, but from the country's political and financial centers of power, and their goal has been preventing regular people from banding together to improve their lot. Polls reveal shockingly high levels of isolation and loneliness among the U.S. population, conditions that are known to make people more susceptible to the destructive, paranoid conspiracy theories that abet the right wing. We are all living amid the wreckage of a long, ongoing, and intentional sabotage of progressive collective action, a profit-driven healthcare system ill-prepared to cope with a pandemic, runaway climate change threatening the future, a bigoted and broken criminal justice system, a misinformation-addled and conspiracy-promoting corporate media sphere, and an economy in which the majority of people can barely keep their heads above water. Our inability to truly conspire is why so many people are struggling to breathe today. The power to define what is and is not a conspiracy is a jealously guarded privilege. Michael Mark Cohen writes in his fascinating book, The Conspiracy of Capital, Law, Violence, and American Popular Radicalism in the Age of Monopoly. In the early days of the United States, this battle would be fought overwhelmingly in the courts. The first labor conspiracy case in the United States was the Philadelphia Cordwainers' Trial of 1805 to 1806, and it remains one of the most significant trials in labor history to this day. A group of journeyman shoemakers attempted to combine to demand higher pay and prevent the hiring of replacement workers, Cohen explains, and in response they were charged with forming a combination and conspiracy to raise wages. Shoemaking was one of the city's most profitable industries, and it was also the most contentious. A dispute over wages led to a 7-week strike and then a lawsuit, with 8 journeymen indicted. A scab testified that workers were foreigners seeking to overthrow the laws of the United States. The trope of the outside agitator was already in effect. The prosecution argued that the workers' collusion threatened not only the shoemaking industry, but also the entire city's economy. While workers got off with a small fine, the case set a disturbing precedent. Other courts interpreted the verdict as a ban on labor unions, which meant that organizing efforts were henceforth subject to suppression from both employers and the state. Between 1806 and 1842, there were more than 21 labor conspiracy trials involving cordwains, tailors, hatters, spinners, and carpet weavers, Cohen reports. Strikers won 6 of them. But in each and every case, unions were deemed illegal combinations and conspiracies and forbidden. Speaking for countless others, Philadelphia labor leader Stephen Simpson railed against a double standard that tilted the playing field in favor of employers. If mechanics combine to raise their wages, the laws punish them as conspirators against the good of society, and the dungeon awaits them as it does the robber, he wrote in 1831. But the laws have made it a just and meritorious act that capitalists shall combine to strip the man of labor of his earnings and reduce him to a dry crust and a gourd of water. Robert G. Ingersoll, A famed agnostic and social reformer would later express the same sentiment in a pithier formulation. If the rich meet to reduce wages, that's a conference. If the poor resist the reduction, that's a conspiracy. The double standard would be etched into law. At the same time workers were under attack, the owning class was provided with a bevy of new rights. A corporation would be redefined as a legal person entitled to equal protection. Limited liability companies received state sanction and support, while labor unions were deemed illegal. As the age of monopoly wore on, conspiracy charges ramped up. The common law doctrine of criminal conspiracy allowed the captains of industry to regulate working-class organization with incessant litigation, turning courtrooms into centers of class conflict. A vague and broad accusation, the conspiracy doctrine implied guilt by association and was used to suppress dissent, to ban unions, outlaw strikes, pickets, and boycotts, to criminalize radical ideologies like anarchism and communism, in Cohen's words. The doctrine was considered the darling of the prosecutor's nursery, for its sweeping application and loose evidentiary rules, which meant it was perfect for suppressing dissent. Anyone could be sucked into the ring of conspirators, even those who had never met before. If there are still any citizens interested in protecting human liberty, let them study the conspiracy laws of the United States, the famed radical lawyer Clarence Darrow implored. No one's liberty is safe. Born in 1857, Darrow defended countless workers and organizers from conspiracy charges over his career, inspired, in part, by the famous Haymarket trial, a miscarriage of justice that saw 8 anarchists charged with conspiracy and 7 sentenced to death for an explosion at a small rally. A pardon would be issued in time to save 3 of them. In an attempt to mount more successful defenses, Darrow dug into the conspiracy doctrine's history to uncover its basis in English common law, only to discover that its original purpose had been turned on its head. First codified in 1305, the conspiracy doctrine began as a medieval English law designed to prevent malicious persecution. It was an ancient law that a man who conspired to use the courts to destroy his fellow men was guilty of treason to the state, Darrow concluded. He had laid his hand upon the state itself. He had touched the bulwark of human liberty. The age of revolution flipped the script, shifting the doctrine's purpose from the prevention and punishment of private abuse of the jury system to the subversion of efforts to build working-class solidarity. In 1721, English judges ruled in Rex v. Journeyman Tailors of Cambridge that workers' efforts to strike to raise wages amounted to an unlawful and criminal conspiracy, setting the stage for the Combination Acts of 1799 and 1800, which made trade unionism illegal in Britain, though laborers continued to put up fierce resistance. The aristocracy were interested in repressing the Jacobin conspiracies of the people, Cohen explains, while the manufacturers were interested in defeating their conspiracies to increase wages. The Combination Acts did both. A cross-section of elites gained power, and labor was forced into the shadows. As a result, the historian E.P. Thompson notes in his study of the English working class, organizing became more furtive, or conspiratorial in its modern-day sense. Workers could unite only in secret, ever watchful for employers, magistrates, parsons, and spies who might be their undoing. Workers fought back, but always from a defensive crouch. In the United States, laborers exploited on the job faced retaliation for demanding better treatment. They could be fired, wounded, or lynched, whether by hired Pinkerton guards or volunteer reactionary mobs. World War I inflamed ethno-nationalist tensions and put targets on the backs of radicals, with thousands arrested and often deported in the infamous Palmer raids. The Wartime Espionage Act strengthened the hand of the state, making it possible to prosecute labor partisans for words alone. The legendary organizer Eugene Debs was jailed for declaring that the only war in which he would enlist was the war of the workers of the world against the exploiters of the world. Voicing that sentiment landed him in prison for sedition, a charge held up by a unanimous Supreme Court decision. With hindsight, we regard the Haymarket Affair, the first wave of the Red Scare, and the Palmer Raids as egregious abuses of state power. But rather than being aberrations, they epitomize a troubling current that has coursed through U.S. history since the colonial days, carried across the Atlantic via British common law all the way to the present day, a disastrous determination to squelch the efforts of working people to become organized. The most dangerous conspiracy theories, especially right-wing conspiracy theories, do not exclusively populate the extremist margins of American politics and history, Cohen observes. Rather, the most dangerous conspiracy theories in American politics emerge from the very center of power, in which white supremacist, anti-communist, and anti-terrorist ideologies, each defined by shifting fears of subversive conspiracies, are promoted and enacted by presidents, business leaders, military men, judges, prosecutors, police, and vigilantes. The most destructive purveyors of conspiracy theories are not average people who anxiously embrace half-truths. Rather, the real threat comes from those who hold official positions of influence and who cynically trade in damaging lies to maintain dominance, fully aware that their continued authority depends on the disorientation, distraction, demoralization, and disarray of millions of others. If that sounds conspiratorial, it is. I think a little conspiratorialism on the left is sometimes healthy. There actually is a cabal of ruling elites that seek to poison and imprison this world in the name of profits, Cohen told me by email. And those people have names, addresses, and regularly meet to plot their crimes against humanity and nature. We have much to gain by naming and fighting them both individually and as a group. In 1961, sociologist Daniel Bell speculated that there is in the American temper a feeling that somewhere, somebody is pulling all the complicated strings to which this jumbled world dances. The esteemed historian Richard Hofstadter echoed that sentiment, publishing The Paranoid Style in American Politics to great acclaim. Over the course of the Trump presidency, countless op-eds, journalistic exposés, academic articles, and books have articulated a similar concern, citing the explosion of conspiracy theories and the elevation of some of the most outlandish ones to the halls of power. The same election that evicted Trump from the White House secured victory for two congressional candidates who publicly supported QAnon, a convoluted conspiracy devoted to interpreting message board missives from Q, a mysterious figure and supposed government insider with knowledge of Trump's plan to vanquish the devil-worshipping, child-molesting globalists who currently run the world, and send them to Guantanamo Bay with the help of John F. Kennedy Jr., who faked his own death in 1999 and has been in hiding ever since. At the end of 2020, NPR and Ipsos published the results of a poll assessing QAnon's reach. 17% of respondents said it was true that a group of Satan-worshipping elites who run a child sex ring are trying to control our politics and media. And 37% more said they didn't know. Without a doubt, it is alarming when millions of people reject basic reality, clinging to the bizarre conviction that an established serial sexual harasser of women and cager of real children at the border is actually the savior of illusory abused youngsters. Yet attempts to diagnose the problem source and identify possible cures too often fall short. The book A Lot of People Are Saying, from 2019, epitomizes the genre. Authors Nancy Rosenblum and Russell Muirhead describe what they call the new conspiracism, or conspiracy without theory. In their schema, classic conspiracism's evidentiary basis, picture dozens of JFK assassination aficionados poring over photographs of the grassy knoll, has been abandoned in favor of pure affect. Hypotheses and suppositions gain purchase through repetition, not proof. Digital networks drown internet users in dubious information designed less to persuade than to overwhelm, as social networks circulate and recirculate sensational claims. Those who know how to game algorithms amass enormous followings, and those with the most engaging content always win, accuracy be damned. In 2020, millions of jobs evaporated overnight, but hucksters hit pay dirt. The clickbait economy launched the careers of an astonishing number of conspiracy entrepreneurs, a handful of whom, like Alex Jones, are national figures, while the vast majority carve out a specialized niche, perhaps exposing crisis actors, the people who purportedly pretend to be victims of mass shootings as part of a larger plot to undermine the Second Amendment, or tracking chemtrails, mind-controlling vapors allegedly released by planes. Rosenblum and Muirhead quote Stephanie McWilliams, a 20-something woman from Belleville, Ontario, who gained notoriety for propagating the myth of Pizzagate, which held that prominent Democratic political operatives, including Hillary Clinton and John Podesta, ran a pedophile ring housed at a popular pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. called Comet Ping Pong, which inspired a man to travel from North Carolina, enter the premises, and fire a military assault rifle, demanding the release of imaginary sex slaves he believed were being held in a non-existent basement. Despite the fact that someone could have been killed during the commotion, McWilliams was unremorseful. "I really have no regrets, and it's honestly really grown our audience." A lot of people are saying maintains that while conspiracism has long pervaded U.S. politics, something significant has changed in recent years. Today, conspiracism is not, as we might expect, the last resort of permanent political losers, but the first resort of winners, the authors observe, in a reference to Donald Trump's rule as conspiracist-in-chief and the Republican Party's tendency to paint itself as a victim even as it wields political power. For all the authors' supposed historical acuity, their insistence that conspiracy theories originating from the powerful is a new phenomenon only holds if you selectively interpret and idealize the past. A cursory glance at U.S. history, or a close read of Michael Mark Cohen, shows that the powerful have claimed to be victims since the founding of the nation. The lies peddled by Trump and the grand old party are just the latest iterations of the truth-destroying, state-building ideologies of yore. Today we use the term Red Scare to indicate an overreaction, but the mania lasted the better part of the 20th century, peaking twice, first around World War I and then after World War II. During the second surge, the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, devoted incredible energy to pinpointing communist influence in government and industry, an influence that zealots detected in New Deal social programs, strong labor protections and trade union militancy, and the civil rights movement, which Representative John Rankin of Mississippi denounced as communistic bunk. Operating in a similar vein, Senator Joseph McCarthy launched a crusade in Congress, seeking out subversive elements in Washington and Hollywood. His efforts lost steam only when they were broadcast on national television, and public opinion turned against his inquisition. It's worth noting that McCarthy's mercenary and underhanded chief counsel, Roy Cohn, went on to become one of Trump's best friends and mentors. But of course, the conspiracism didn't stop with the end of the demented government hearings. Under the fervid anti-communist leadership of J. Edgar Hoover, the Federal Bureau of Investigation continued to spy on citizens, including via COINTELPRO, a counterintelligence program designed to surveil, infiltrate, discredit, and disrupt left-wing groups. As one official memo put it, The aim was to enhance the paranoia endemic in dissident circles and convince activists that FBI agents lurked behind every mailbox. A letter sent by the program tried to pressure Martin Luther King Jr. to kill himself. The CIA abetted the cause with...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?